Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you are listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate the support. If you like the show, you can rate the show. You can share it with your friends and family. That's how it grows. We appreciate that. You can connect with me on the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at Macroaggressions. We've got an Instagram account, at Macroaggressions Podcast, so check that out. We couldn't do this show without the amazing support of our sponsors. We appreciate them. Legal Shield has been in business for 50 years in the United States and Canada. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, and it's just the collective buying power of all of us, regular old people, directed towards specific high-powered law firms in your area. So what it means is you get access to an attorney that you probably couldn't afford or wouldn't want to afford for a dollar a day. It's $30 a month. It is the most affordable service out there. I'm telling you, if you want to get some legal documents taken care of in advance and justify the cost over the next, I don't know, pay itself off for the next couple of years, month one, sign up, go talk to someone about getting your last will and testament, your financial power of attorney, your medical power of attorney, get all those documents done, sorted out, put in your safe and out of the way so that you have them. If you die in America and you don't have a will, then the state gets involved in your affairs and you never want that to happen. Legal Shield has avenues for you to protect yourself by getting in front of attorneys that have on average 22 years of experience. So some really some lawyers that know their way around, know what they're doing. If you get traffic tickets, red light camera tickets, parking ticket, whatever you've got, send it to your attorney. You have access to it now. So I'll tell you what, if this sounds like something you might be interested in, or you know someone that might be interested in it, take a look at the website, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com, and see what you think. They have all kinds of items on there. If you run a small business, there's something for you there. If you're somebody that carries a gun, they have the legal paperwork for you to get on board over there. So there's plenty going on. I feel like it's time that we take back our power. I don't like the idea of the big guys pushing us around. So that's why we picked the domain don'tgetpushedaround.com. Check it out. See what you think. Also, Chemical Free Body has been with us since the beginning. They're making great vitamin supplements in an industry where most of it is garbage. Let's be honest here. Tim James over there at Chemical Free Body saved his life by changing his health. And he appreciates the second chance he was given. He is determined to make sure that he spreads the message of health and wellness with as many people as he can. And he does so by making products that are really, really fantastic. I drink Grain 85 every single morning. Every single morning, no joke. So take a look at chemicalfreebody.com and see what they have available there. If you find something that you like, just use the promo code MACRO and you'll get a discount on everything that you order. If there's something that is incorrect with your order, reach out to the people over at Chemical Free Body. They'll take care of it. And they've got a double your money back price guarantee, which nobody ever uses because their products actually work. So if you're looking to take back control of your health, the only person that's going to do it is you. So if you've made the decision to get healthy, go to chemicalfreebody.com. On your way out, use the promo code MACRO to save yourself a little bit of money. Well, I'm excited for this interview. And in the interest of time, we recorded this intro a little bit separately so that we could maximize the amount of time that we have with Whitney getting into all of the good stuff. So without further ado, the interview with Whitney Webb. With us now, the host of the Unlimited Hangout podcast, the author of unlimitedhangout.com and the author of One Nation Under Blackmail, Volume 1 and 2. Whitney Webb is back. Hey, Whitney, how are you? Good to see you again.
Hey, doing great. Great to be back on Macroaggressions.
Well,
all is well with you.
All is well with me until I start reading your articles and I think, God damn it, this world is so dangerous and there's a bunch of stuff falling apart. You have a great article from the middle of May on Eric Prince. And I'll tell you, I never liked this guy from the beginning. Whenever I saw him, he was sort of brought to us in the Blackwater era as this guy who's going to come in and help, I don't know, privatize our military, like our military needs
to save money, right?
Oh, to save money. Yeah, we're all of a sudden we're pinching pennies in the military now, don't you know? Like we're clipping coupons and shopping at Ross. Eric Prince is going to come in and save the day. Excuse me if I just feel a little bit suspicious about this guy. Your article, The Prince and the Spy, he's the prince. The spy is Latell Lashem, right? This is an Israeli lady. Let's talk about Eric Prince. Who is Eric Prince? And is this guy... what's his relationship to the global deep state?
Right. So Eric Prince is best known as you brought them up already, for being the guy behind Blackwater, which has undergone a few transformations since it was named Blackwater. I think now it's Academy, and I think it's actually owned by Apollo Global Management, Leon Black, funny enough.
I wonder if he negotiated those deals over at Epstein's house.
Yeah, well, as we'll get to in a second, if you, you know, talk about Epstein and the Iran-Contra network and look at Eric Prince and, you know, what that network is today, you know, maybe there's something there, but don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So anyway, Eric Prince, you know, left Blackwater when it was really infamous and then it underwent those name changes and he sort of tried to distance himself from it. And has been involved pretty much ever since then in lobbying the U.S. federal government to privatize various other war efforts, most recently in Ukraine, where he was trying to sort of pitch his services to both sides. So not just like the U.S., right, but also the Wagner Group of Russia. And then, of course, before then was trying to push for privatization of the Afghanistan conflict and also AFRICOM stuff, you know, basically U.S. military operations in Africa. And at that same time, he also got increasingly involved with Chinese state-owned companies through his Frontier Services Group and some of the subsidiaries of that. And it was sold, the main owner of that while Prince was running it was CITIC, which is the largest Chinese state-owned conglomerate, but obviously a lot of ties to the CCP there. And then, of course, it gets weird when you consider that Eric Prince has long been very close to Trump land, which is supposed to be very anti-CCP. And why are they so welcoming of this guy? We can get into why that might be later. But essentially, you know, Eric Prince is this operative, I guess I would say, and he's sort of, you know, it's been forgotten, I guess you could say, that he was very close to the CIA, why he ran Blackwater, and is a documented CIA asset, at least until 2010. But you could argue probably later than that. And at the very least, he's definitely come under the influence or under the payroll. You know, he might be on the payroll. Probably both of Israeli intelligence, which is sort of what this article is about, because he got involved with this woman who you mentioned earlier, Lital Lashem, who is provably part of this Epstein, Ehud Barak network of Israeli intelligence. You know, obviously most intelligence agencies, you know, have factionalism within them, competing power factions, like every other part of the quote unquote deep state in any country, really, because every country essentially has one, right? So that's essentially who he's teamed up with. And you have him getting involved with what appears to be a front company for Israeli intelligence that's exploiting loopholes to sell Israeli defense ware and arms and other things to the U.S., even though a lot of things produced abroad or certain sensitive electronics and things like that have to be produced in the U.S. or at least, you know, by U.S. corporations for national security purposes. And this company is essentially loopholing all of that. Yeah, so that's sort of a bird's eye view. I mean, there's a lot more detail there that we can go into wherever you'd like to.
So we've got Frontier Research Group, which is his Africa China investment
sort of group. It's about securing mineral resources and other resources for China within Africa. And this is interesting too, because ostensibly the U.S. is competing for those same resources within Africa. And so he's backing one side, but also playing the other side of groups, you know, like the Make America Great Again faction, right? Who ostensibly wants that for the U.S., you know, and he's selling it to the other side. So
is this part of Belt and Road Initiative then?
Because it's with Belt and Road, totally.
Okay. So he's
openly been facilitating that, Eric Prince.
Okay. All right. So he's essentially a Chinese agent at this point, because if we're talking about Belt and Road, which isn't wholly Chinese, but I think they run a little over 25% of the project, and certainly do finance it through through direct finance, through the Asian infrastructure banks and the like. So
yeah, I mean, a lot of it see it as sort of like a, you know, China, I guess you could say, empire building in a sense, mm-hmm. or at least influence expansion at the very least. Definitely trying to sort of pick up where, well, there's all this talk, right, about how China's filling the vacuum left by U.S. Poor foreign policy decisions, mm-hmm. In various parts of the world. And so this is sort of Belt and Road, I guess. I'm not an expert on it, but sort of as I see it, is them feeling a lot of that infrastructure vacuum that was sort of pitched that the U.S. was going to do under the guise of nation building and all of this stuff, but was obviously involved with a lot of grift and corruption on the U.S. that made it a lot, you know, very untenable most of the time due to the involvement of contractors and all of that stuff. And then you have China coming in and doing it their way, yeah. which tends to be more effective for, you know, it gets built instead of just half built. And then there's like all this money missing. I mean, that's sort of like the U.S. model often. But China, of course, has, you know, a lot of financial interest in those infrastructure projects once they're built, which sort of link them indefinitely to the Chinese orbit. Right. So that's sort of what is going on here.
I had John Perkins on, and his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, changed my life. When I read it in 2007, it put me on a different path. And we were talking about the role of the Chinese economic hitman in Africa, as opposed to the role that he played as a U.S. economic hitman in South America. And he said, you know, it's all bad either way, of course, but he said, at least with us. And he said, I'm not trying to justify what we did, but he says, at least with us, when we built a hydroelectric power plant, it worked. It stayed up. It stayed functional, you know, for a while. It wasn't poorly built. And he said, my fear is that with these Chinese, with China going into Africa, yeah, they'll build out the dam. Yeah, they'll build out this infrastructure, but they'll build it the way the Chinese build it, which is it's just about to fall down and held together with duct tape. And I thought, oh, well, I guess that's one way.
I don't know if that's necessarily true, right? Because so much of everything today is made in China, and some of it's flimsy and falls apart, and some of it's not. Yeah. You know, maybe it'll work for slightly less time. But, you know, again, the U.S. has, you know, a varied success rate. And a lot of that depends on who the contractor is, you know, at the end of the day, because it's not really the U.S. government usually building it. They contract it out. It's sort of like a public-private system.
Right.
A lot of the time.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so we go through this stage with Eric Prince. We have this slaughter in Iraq by Blackwater troops. Really bad.
And also sex trafficking and all sorts of weird stuff going on with BlackRock and other theaters of war.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Yeah. I'm not surprised, because anywhere where there's war, you're going to find human trafficking.
Vulnerable arms. People that you can exploit for all sorts of purposes. Yeah.
All sorts of purposes. Yeah. This gets me. So he leaves America under a cloud of, just real bad publicity. Relocates to United Arab Emirates, starts this process kind of all over, the rebranding, the building up of new companies. Starts to create. Let's talk about this UAE company called Dark Matter.
I didn't look too deep into them for the article. Just the fact that it's sort of like the Emirati equivalent of something like Black Cube is for Israel.
That's what I was going to ask.
Privatized front for their intelligence services. Black Cube is an admitted front for Israel. And actually, Latal Hashem worked there as
scrubbed
well.
It. Didn't she scrub it from her?
He scrubbed it.
From her LinkedIn?
Well, this was reporting on Carbine 911, which came out during the Epstein scandal, because Epstein and I believe also Leslie Wexner had poured millions into that company at the behest of Ehud Barak, who was the chairman of the board. And then he leaves after the Epstein stuff. And so do these other Epstein associates or obvious Israeli intelligence guys on the board, like Nicole Yunkerman, Pinchas Bukris. And then they get replaced by Christian Nielsen, former head of DHS, and, you know, people that look more American, because Carbon 911 is specifically marketing to the United States. Yeah. And then after Carbine, she leaves and, you know, starts advising Toka, which is Ehud Barak's subsequent company after Carbine, which is basically NSO Group on steroids, contracting directly for the CIA and any national government, but that is allied with Israel. So you cannot support Palestinians and use Toka products. Essentially, you have to be supportive of Israeli domestic and foreign policy for them to, you know, give you their wares, surveillance wares. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting little tidbit that, but not a surprise when you've got Ehud Barak involved in anything. It's not good. Obviously, former prime minister. What was his title?
Former prime minister, former defense minister, and former head of Israeli military intelligence when Robert Maxwell worked for Israeli military intelligence, for example. And there, when Epstein was allegedly recruited into the Israeli intelligence fold and approved by higher ups in Israeli military intelligence, which we can assume is probably Ehud Barak, that's what Robert Maxwell told Ari Ben Menashe, who he was working with at the time, on behalf of Israeli military intelligence and Iran-Contra stuff.
So we've got Ehud Barak tied to Carbine 9/11. We've got him tied to Toka. They're looking for BDS allies. Actually, more importantly, they're looking for BDS enemies, I would suggest.
I think this is it's more than that. I think it's part of this Abraham Accord pivot. So they're looking for like Saudi Arabia under MBS, and they're looking for the United Arab Emirates, right? Because later, Latal Hashem and these other guys tied up in that network, or the people that are close to Eric Prince, like Dorian Barak. I don't think there's any relation to Ehud Barak, by the way. But they get involved in this Israeli UAE Business Council, and I think they founded it. the two of them and were a key part of negotiating the Abraham Accords, at least the UAE side of it. And then you have Prince there in that mix as well, being very involved with them in their intelligence fronts, like dark matter, which he starts shopping around their wares to different countries. And he's basically essentially deepening this sort of nexus that exists between Israel and China. Which I talked about in my book as it relates to why was Epstein at the Clinton White House and why was the main person he was meeting with a central figure in quote unquote Chinagate, also known as the campaign finance scandal of 1996. I would say both are really misnomers. What you have going on there is the Iran-Contra crew together again, basically the CIA and Israeli intelligence, but instead of doing arms stuff with South America or the Middle East and drugs, it's weapons, Chinese weapons being funneled into the U.S. after they're banned by Clinton. They're being covertly funneled in by Southern Air Transport, which is being essentially run by Leslie Wexner's The Limited and Epstein. You know, Clinton had nominally banned these weapons as part of this Chinagate lobbying thing. And because they were trying to get China most favored nation trading status. And the only way he could get that passed in a way that was politically, politically salient, I guess, was if he at the same time banned the sale of Chinese arms in the U.S. because of gang violence and things like that in the U.S. And so he did that, but somehow the Chinese weapons keep coming in. Well, I wonder.
So I'll ban it, but then you just bring it in through Wexner's Southern Air Transport, aka American Air, and just bring it in the back door, and we'll just say that it's banned, but wink, wink.
Yeah, and Southern Air Transport. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And Southern Air Transport was the Iran-Contra airline moving weapons around. And before that, it was Air America moving weapons around. I mean, this is what it does. And Wexner and Epstein were specifically targeting Southern Air Transport. Well, before that, they tried another CIA-linked airline tied up with Iran-Contra too, called Aero Air. And that didn't work out. And then they moved on to Southern Air Transport. But they're specifically courting airlines that would serve that purpose, right?
And
there's also this tech transfer element. Oh, sorry.
It went as far as to relocate Southern Air Transport to Columbus, Ohio, right?
Then instead of going from where its former headquarters, Miami, from Miami to Latin America and back, it's going from Columbus, Ohio to Hong Kong.
Yeah. For clothes.
For clothes.
for the limited, for these Victoria's Secret underwear aren't going to make themselves,
undies.
Right? We got to get them from somewhere. Holy moly. So they used this rat line that they'd been using for decades, right? So they just pivot from, well, instead of guns from South America, it's guns from China. And we run this route. We've got, then you bring the whole gang back together from Iran-Contra. We start to see the same names come up again. Mark Middleton, again, he made it through the 90s without getting himself shot in the chest with a shotgun, only to have that fate find him, last year, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here? We've got... we've got the makings of a, I don't know. We've got...
Yeah, so let me explain Chinagate a little bit, and you'll see why it's important in the context of this Eric Prince stuff. So I mentioned earlier that Eric Prince's Africa-China thing is majority owned by CITIC. So this is the main conglomerate that's involved in Chinagate on behalf of the Chinese government. The other company is China Resources. They're both state-owned. So how does Chinagate essentially start, and why is it tied up with Iran-Contra? So if you look at Iran-Contra as it relates to Clinton's involvement when he's governor of Arkansas, who are the people that are backing Clinton during that time that have businesses that are involved in Iran-Contra? That would be Jackson Stevens, right? Also the Riotti family, who are early partners of Jackson Stevens and Little Rock Riotti. The Riottis are based in Indonesia, but basically have giant conglomerates throughout Southeast Asia and also a subsidiary in the U.S. Via their company, the Lippo Group. So in the early 90s, the Lippo Group is basically bailed out by the Chinese government or some of these Chinese conglomerates and Chinese state-owned banks. And they also try and court the US, the Chinese government to help them rescue BCCI Hong Kong, which was going under when BCCI collapsed in 1991. And BCCI, of course, was the big intelligence front bank for money laundering and all sorts of crazy stuff, including child sex trafficking to VIPs of the United Arab Emirates. That's in a Senate report. So that's like a definite thing. Anyway, they don't help them rescue BCCI HK, but they do start buying a bunch of, I guess, stakes in different Lippo Group entities and rescue a failing subsidiary called Lippoland and all sorts of stuff. So they basically become business partners. The Chinese government and the Riadis, and this is as Clinton's running for president, and then the Riadis engage in all this influence peddling, and a bunch of people tied to them are the central figures in Chinagate, and it's called a campaign finance scandal because basically you have a bunch of non-citizens, mainly based in China or Indonesian in the case of the Lippo Group, or Taiwan, tied to the KMT, and other entities that are funneling a bunch of money to Clinton's campaign. It happened in 1992, but it was under investigation only with Clinton's reelection campaign. They did the same thing a couple times. And, the question is, yes, the donations were illegal. They were donating through strawmen. And you can't donate to American elections unless you are an American citizen, right? So this was illegal, yes, but no one seemed to be interested in asking what these people were trying to buy, right? Like, why were they trying to give all this money to Clinton? So if you look at it, they were very interested in the Commerce Department, specifically Ron Brown, who ends up dying suspiciously in the mix of all of this. And, there's this most favored nation trading status I mentioned. There's the weapons angle and there's this tech transfer angle. And one of the main guys at the center of it is this guy named Wang Jun, who's China's premier arms dealer. And he runs CITIC, which is involved with this arms stuff and this tech transfer stuff specifically. And that is the same company that becomes involved with Eric Prince before he creates this front company to sell stuff that normally couldn't be sold to the U.S. military, to the U.S. military. And he does that by partnering with Latal Lashem, who's part of this same Israeli Epstein Ehud Barak network that engaged and helped facilitate this in Chinagate, right? And that's why I would argue conservatives in the U.S. never properly dug into Chinagate, even though they like to hate on China, because Israel's there and Republicans can't hate on Israel and get elected. You know, look at this election cycle. You have the two main candidates on the Republican Party, Ron DeSantis and Donald Trump, just in the past few weeks talking about, how much they love Israel, their great loyalty to Israel and all this stuff. I mean, part of it's probably related to Israel's founding in the Nakba and things like that having taken place recently. But there's been a very big display. And of course, if you remember back to Trump's presidency, lots of displays about, Israel. A lot of that, of course, having to do with who bankrolled him the first time, namely Sheldon Adelson and people like that. So hopefully that explains the China connection here, the Israel connection a little bit, because a lot of the same network we see appear again sort of with this group around Eric Prince now. So Eric Prince, what else has he been involved in the same period? He's in the UAE and also a lot of the places he's in Africa, I think like Oman and Libya, involved in weird stuff there. It's a lot of the same haunts of the Iran-Contra people back in the 80s and the 70s. Like the whole Ted Shackley related network I talk about in the book that sort of forms the early Iran-Contra nexus, at least the U.S. side of that is very involved there. And now it seems like he's involved in that and involved with this sort of China-Israel nexus that, of course, involves U.S. intelligence, but the U.S. intelligence faction that's aligned with that. So it's kind of confusing to explain if you don't know the history of Iran-Contra, because it's sort of, A lot of people just don't know about it, I guess. And then you have sort of what I see as Iran-Contra 2.0, which is China Gate. And now it's sort of still going on, but in a way to intentionally undermine U.S. military power before, you know, at the same time, Biden, whose biggest donor in 2020 was the same guy who was central to ChinaGate on the tech transfer angle, Bernard Schwartz, is the guy that's trying to push us to World War III with China, while, you know, the whole technological advantage of our military has been sold out over the past 30 years by the DNC specifically. And Republicans uninterested in investigating again because of, I would argue, the Israeli lobby.
Well, if there was a bank at the center of the Iran-Contra, or just sort of deeply involved in the deep state nonsense, BCCI, that was all the rage in the 80s and I guess shut down early 90s, then if we've got ChinaGate 2.0, if we've got Iran-Contra revisited, do we have BCCI revisited? Is there a new version of this bank?
I think so. This is something that I've been trying to look into, but I've been a little short on time since the book came out because I had a lot of other projects I wanted to get back into after the book was done. But yeah, most definitely. I think there was an effort to rebuild BCCI, but not necessarily put their eggs all in one basket, you know? So I think it became a network of banks. And I think a lot of this is tied up with JP Morgan and Jamie Dimon. I think it's tied up with why Bear Stearns collapsed and Epstein's involvement there. And probably Goldman Sachs, which is the former bank of people like Robert Rubin that were involved with a lot of this weird stuff going on in the Clinton administration, including being the first person to invite Jeffrey Epstein to the White House in 1993. And of course, Goldman Sachs was a major enabler of Robert Maxwell's crimes, financial crimes. And then he goes straight to being Clinton's national economic director, which is, you know, why he invited Epstein to the White House. Ostensibly, he was in that position when he made that invitation. And there was obviously a lot of weird stuff going on. So I don't think it's necessarily one bank. It seems like they tried to work through several different banks and sort of tie them together. And I would suspect as the too big to fail model has advanced, it's advanced very fast since BCCI collapsed. You're essentially getting one bank to rule them all, you know? And so a lot of these smaller banks, like, so for example, I wrote a series about Jamie Dimon and his history. So the bank that he took over in 2000, Bank One, was involved in Iran-Contra money laundering and was very close to Wexner. Leslie Wexner's orbit in Columbus, Ohio. It's been folded into JP Morgan. So has Chase Manhattan Bank, previously run by people like David Rockefeller. And ever since him, of course, Rockefeller cronies have been in charge. And you have those banks existing within JP Morgan and a lot of other banks, of course, because they've just been swallowing them up. And the same with Citigroup, which is the other bank that Jamie Dimon helped build up with his mentor, Sandy Weill. Citigroup exists because it began with a company called Commercial Credit Corporation, a subsidiary of Controlled Data Corporation, which, as I note in the article, is tied up with the same Iran-Contra group, you know, from the 80s, that same nexus, and involved with these tech transfers. Robert Maxwell is tied up with Controlled Data Corporation, Samuel Pisar, and a lot of this weird tech transfer stuff, which again, you know, we've talked about that in the context of Iran-Contra, but it's worth saying that Samuel Pisar, who, by the way, was not just Robert Maxwell's best friend and confidant, he's the person who raised current U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, told Congress in the early 1970s that they were building a single unified one world economy, well, global economy, and that capitalist Western capitalist enterprises were merging their operations with communist-owned state corporations. And this was being done by tech transfers and joint ventures and things of that nature. And that the idea is that this global economic network would be more powerful than any nation state, and that the model of the nation state was quickly becoming irrelevant. This was in the early 70s, and he just told Congress that straight up.
Oh, man, he sounds like he would fit in on any variety of boards, United Nations.
Yeah, so now you kind of get why these guys tend to pop up at places like the Trilateral Commission.
Trilateral Commission.
Which has essentially the same goal that sort of Samuel Pisar laid out there. And when you consider the stuff going on with ChinaGate and the tech transfers, why is Iran those guys and the CIA doing that? Why are these guys in Israel doing that? Because, of course, you know, Maxwell and Pisar are very much closer to Israel than they were to the U.S., for sure. You know, it seems like this plan has advanced quite far.
Yeah. David Rockefeller, the ghost of David Rockefeller is smiling in hell, I would imagine. I don't know. This is a dream that these guys had for a long time. But I'll tell you, there's part of me that feels like, oh man, these guys are building a one world government and it's unstoppable and they've got all the pieces to, you know, the people in the right places and they've got the ability to control it. And then I look at it, it's sort of what happened during COVID, and I realized that like they couldn't roll out universal vaccinations without having to devolve into giving away free donuts to get people to do it. So there's part of me that wonders like, well, how omnipotent are these people? You know, that they've got the people in place, they've got the connections and they're working behind the scenes, and all this sounds very ominous and scary. We know about the United Nations push, this sustainable, we're going to get into that, the sustainable development goals and how that sort of folds you into this weird one world government. And it all feels almost like it's going to happen no matter what. But then I just remember that there's incompetence kind of baked into this too. Like these people don't ever, they're not.
Yeah.
Gods. They think they're gods, of course, but they're not gods, and they make a lot of mistakes. And as we see this
right.
idea of rolling everybody into a world government, I've got to think, well, there's going to be factions fighting within that, even, right? Is this is untenable?
Yeah, well, I definitely think that's an important angle to consider, the factionalism, and I think that's ultimately going to spell doom for their project. And I've always said the question is, it's not so much if they're going to succeed. It's like, how much damage do they do before they fail?
Right.
So I think that's the big question that we should be looking at. But look, so in the context of what we've been talking about thus far, essentially what I see is a setup whereby the U.S. Instigates most likely some sort of World War III scenario, and its entire military advantage has been destroyed from within and sent to the ostensible adversary we will be facing down, China and Russia. And it's set up so the U.S. Intentionally fails and falls. And I think part of that is necessary because even if it's quite clear to people like us that the U.S. doesn't actually represent these things, at least not anymore, this idea, you know, that the U.S. represents individual freedom, nationalism, all of that stuff, they have to turn those values into the bad guys to advance this multipolar world order that Russia and China are promoting. And if you look at how Russia and China talk about the multipolar world order, they refer to it as under the auspices of the UN and Agenda 2030, the Sustainable Development Goals. That is the multipolar order they seek to build. And isn't it weird that the U.S. government developed a lot of the Sustainable Development Goals in negotiations? For example, Sustainable Development Goal 16, which we just put an article out on Unlimited Hangout, openly admitted to have been the majority of it designed and written by the Obama administration, and Samantha Power specifically, who was Obama's ambassador to the UN and currently runs USAID, USAID, and Sustainable Development Goal 16 as one of its you know, sub-targets that's contained within the goal. So Sustainable Development Goal 16.9 is the push for complete digital ID all over the world, which is really a linchpin for this. And what do you know? Samantha Power, as head of USAID, is funding and promoting digital ID projects all over the world, including Ukraine's DIA app, for example. So but
they just want to make sure they know where everybody is. USAID is they're there to help. They're certainly not a regime change operation disguised as
they're widely seen, at least within independent media, as a CIA cutout. Right. So why do you have Russia and China supporting stuff that was designed by the Obama administration and people like Samantha Power? And how is that going to be any different than the world that, you know, the Biden administration and people like John Kerry, the climate envoy, are going around and trying to build, or like people like Mike Bloomberg, who's handling climate finance for the UN with Mark Carney, former head of the Bank of England and Bank of Canada, the guy that got HSBC off the hook for laundering money for drug cartels and all other sorts of funny business.
I guess Satan himself was busy and Mark Carney had to step in instead.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, there's a lot of disagreement within independent media right now over whether multipolarity, as it's being sold, is going to be anything different than what's going on right now. And maybe it will be different, but it doesn't really seem like it will be that different. I mean, if you were against the stuff being rolled out in COVID, mass biometric surveillance, for example, and things of that nature, it's very clear that Russia and China are actually farther ahead than the West on implementing those measures in those countries. Mm-hmm. And Western elites are trying to impose those on their countries right now. So in my opinion, it's important to be ideologically consistent. And if you oppose it in the West, you should oppose it anywhere. So again, if that is the paradigm that's being openly supported by Russia and China and also the BRICS countries, like if you look at Brazil right now, a lot of crazy stuff going on right now, that's definitely not, freedom friendly or civil liberty friendly, to say the least. It looks like BRICS is definitely full steam ahead with Agenda 2030, which again is designed mostly by Western elites.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. BRICS is expanding. It looks like they've got more applications in.
To get Argentina and Mexico here where I live in South America. They are clearly pushing for a South American union under the model of the European Union. And if you're familiar with the plans of Rockefeller-linked entities for global government going back decades, it's all these regional unions like the European Union, North American Union, South American Union, Eurasian Union, European Union, African Union. Wow, all those unions pretty much exist except for the ones in the Americas right now by that name, Eurasian Union. Look it up. African Union, look it up. European Union, we all know that's there. So, you know, you have all of those pop up and then you have your world government when they all decide to collaborate together for the good of the planet and develop sustainably, which if you actually look into what sustainable development is for the UN, it's stuff like having a sustainable debt level. What does that have to do with the environment? No, it's just like banker gobbledygook and there's nothing sustainable about it. And, you know, in my opinion, it's pretty clear that bankers here and intelligence agencies are running the show. And some of my other work has pointed out that there is a deliberate effort right now in the U.S. Well, mainly it's the U.S., U.K. and Israel operating out of the World Economic Forum to merge national security agencies, intelligence agencies with Wall Street commercial banks and banking regulators to protect the financial system from cyber attacks and from cyber criminals. And cyber criminals don't just include hackers, according to these people. They include people who spread disinformation to weaken democracy online. So
whatever that means.
A lot going on there. Yep. I think we can guess what that means.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a bunch of moving parts going on right now. But I, again, think there should be a lot of skepticism, not just about UN sustainable development. But, you know, if a country is backing that, we should be skeptical of their intentions and not just assume good intentions because the U.S. are the quote unquote bad guys. And so the people that oppose them must be the quote unquote good guys. You know, this is the real world. It's not a comic book. Right. So there tends to be a lot of different things going on. And more often than not, people that have been denied the top seat at the table probably want the top seat at the table. You know, that doesn't mean they're good guys. It just means they want to be top dog for a while after not being top dog for a while.
Yeah. So. Spoiler alert for the movie, there's multiple bad guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's this idea that global government will never work. And maybe they're right. But this lately, there's a sort of word change. And it's not that they're pushing for global government. They're pushing for global governance. And there's a difference to that. There's this, it feels like if they can click up everybody into these bigger groups, we don't need to call it world government world. We can just work together. and set the policies for all these similar regions and just say, well, you just govern it the way we like it done, and you do it do it your little flavor, whatever works best in the Middle East. We're not going to say that what works in America is going to work in the Middle East. You do it your way. But in the overall overarching theme is, let's manage it a certain way. And then I see these SDG 16, right? Sustainable Development Goals 16, empower global governance regimes. We see exploit threats, real or imagined, to advance regime objectives, and then force unwanted centrally controlled global system of digital ID. So
that's what it essentially, I mean, that's what it actually is. So like they define it as things like, I mean, there's like probably 12 different policy goals rolled in to Sustainable Development Goal 16. And the short version they give for 16 is peaceful, inclusive societies and strong institutions. Yeah. So, yeah. So when you look into it and you realize that, you know, the UN for each of these sub goals has designated custodian agencies within the UN, like UNESCO or Interpol, other entities allied with the UN as the people do to implement it, it starts to get a little more interesting. So a lot of the sub goals deal with crime in SDG 16, like we got to stop corruption and bribery. We have to stop organized crime. We have to stop arms trafficking. We have to stop violence and trafficking of children and things like that. And so how are they going to deliver these peaceful societies? Well, Interpol developed its global policing goals to help implement SDG 16 specifically after being asked to do so by the UN. And if you look at the global policing goals, it's all about surveillance and pre-crime. So you have a peaceful society delivered by a new and incredibly invasive surveillance paradigms. And of course, this is enabled by another part of SDG 16, the digital ID. The digital ID facilitates the end of financial privacy, right? Through its connection to the CBDC or really any other digital token they decide to use. Because one of the main goals of the global policing goals of Interpol is curbing illicit markets, making sure you're buying stuff you're not allowed to buy by the state, whether it's, guns or meat or, whatever they decide to add to it. You know, that's illicit market far as sustainable development will be concerned. And so this is a way to stop people from buying things they're not allowed to buy. So you have to have a complete control over, well, essentially every financial transaction has to be on the system you're surveilling, right? So that's why digital ID is being pushed. And then also geolocation. This is how the UN is going to sell it. You know, the extreme border crisis that's not just going on in the US with the US-Mexico border. It's also going on all over South America. Right. It's a huge issue in where I live in Chile, for example, you know, and so and also, of course, in Europe. So they're going to be like, well, oh, we let all these migrants in, but you guys want to work. Right. So now we have to have digital ID to know who can work and who cannot. That's the US E-Verify program that's being rolled out. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. And the worse illegal immigration gets in the US, the more they're hoping anyway that people will ask for a solution. Which would be that, right? So again, once you have this digital ID thing, which as designed by these actors is tied to everything from your healthcare to your phone, internet access, travel, all of that, you know, they can surveil you and make sure you're not engaging in illegal activity or participating in illicit markets or, engaging in thought crime and posting cyber criminal content online. Interpol is actually one of the leading actors of this WEF entity that I talked about earlier, the whole cyber crime, protect the financial system, let's merge Wall Street and the CIA. Interpol is a big part of that. So, you know, that's essentially what's going on here. And so the idea is we'll have peaceful societies because everything will be surveilled. And the second someone does something wrong, we'll know about it and come after them. Then there will be peace.
I'll be buying black market hamburgers out of the trunk of some car behind 7-Eleven pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to barter and not have your phone on you. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And wear a ski mask made out of a Mylar blanket.
This is scary, man. This is a scary thing. We get into this is the, but this, the importance, the importance of the SDG agenda, would you say that it is predicated, or maybe you would describe it maybe as the linchpin is the digital ID? Without the digital ID, none of this stuff really works very well.
It doesn't work very well.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
At least as far as it's concerned with controlling human interactions and, like, you know, control over the economy, because a big goal of the SDG 16 and some other SDGs, and more broadly, the whole push behind CBDCs, as far as groups like the BIS is concerned, is to end the informal economy. The goal is to have everything done in the informal economy be onboarded to the formal economy so it can be surveilled and tracked and analyzed by AI, probably. And a lot of this about AI, whether it's finances or law enforcement stuff, is all about predictive analytics. So what people might do in the future. And this is obviously very ominous when we involve law enforcement, because that's pre-crime. And a lot of these entities have been very interested in pre-crime for a very long time. That's why you have Palantir, for example, piloting predictive policing as far back as 2014 in the US. And all sorts of Bill Barr under Trump created a pre-crime program in the U.S. that obviously could be expanded by the FBI, which is part of that same WEF entity trying to stomp out cyber criminals with Interpol for the good of SDG 16. I mean, it's nuts. There's a lot of really crazy stuff going on.
I'd prefer if the FBI perfected post-crime before they started worrying about pre-crime. They're not even.
Yeah, but it's not about stopping crime, right?
No,
it's about them being allowed to do all the crime they want, and everyone else isn't allowed to engage in the crime.
They don't want competition. That's the Ron Paul. Yeah. Don't steal. The government hates competition. That's where we are.
Yes. Yeah. So that's really what a lot of this is about. So, for example, more stuff in SDG 16, 16.10. So the 10th of like the 12 sub goals is says it to guarantee access to public information, or guarantee public access to information and protect fundamental freedoms. That sounds nice, but it turns out that what they mean by information, the implementing agency for this, by the way, is UNESCO. And UNESCO says what they mean by information is not access to all information. It's public access to information produced by governments with the intention of it being consumed by the public. And that you'll be guaranteed access to that. So examples they give are like COVID-19 health data, budget expenditures. Okay. So in the US, it's pretty much been proven that a lot of the COVID-19 health data has been fudged or manipulated in various ways to give the impression that things are happening differently than they are, to justify policy decisions that are unnecessary, whether it's the vaccination campaign or lockdowns or what have you. The budget. FASAB 56 is a policy in the U.S. That came out a few years ago, whereby any agency of the federal government, including the military, can have a private set of books of where the money actually went, and then a public set of books that can be entirely different from the actual real set of books, and they don't have to tell you if it was altered or not. So that's the information you're guaranteed public access to. There's nothing in UN SDG 16. 10 to guarantee that the information is accurate or correct. And if you look at the UN itself, it essentially wants to be the arbiter of what is true and what is not. And the UN provably lies a lot. Just on COVID-19 vaccines, for example, the UN's anti-disinformation website on COVID-19 called Verified still to this day says that the COVID-19 vaccine stops transmission of COVID, and that you should take it to protect your loved ones, even though this has been hugely debunked and is even acknowledged by, I think, even the World Health Organization. They say that's true, and everything else that's not on the Verified website per the UN is misinformation, right? And then you get to this new stuff that's been coming out of the UN, the Human Rights Council, and also from the Secretary General himself, saying that we must counter disinformation to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms. Oh, so that's why it was guarantee public access to information and protect fundamental freedoms. To protect our fundamental freedoms, we must counter and censor disinformation. Okay, so they've taken something that sounds like guarantee access to all information, and they've used it to justify mass censorship.
This is the group, UNESCO, who held the emergency meeting last summer to talk about conspiracy theories.
They were created by a guy that wanted to make eugenics great again. He openly said so when UNESCO was founded. Julian Huxley, former head of the British Eugenics Society, that came up with the term transhumanism.
So the transhumanism guy. Who started UNESCO, who definitely doesn't want to kill everybody, is in charge of the information. Right. Yeah. What could possibly go wrong? I mean, really, the COVID, you think they got the COVID information wrong before. Just wait until they have no sort of competition, because but we see this sort of rolling out in slow motion as we see the censorship. It starts with deboosting, it goes to deplatforming, it goes to depersoning. You know, we get into this situation in the alternative media where we're constantly juggling, trying to find a place where we can post something or have a conversation without it getting community notes on it or outright banned. And we have been experiencing this for a while. I think a lot of normies out there that don't really know about it and don't really post content that's outside of the areas of accepted Discord would say, oh, you guys are crazy. What are you guys talking about? There's no censorship here. But this has been rolling out for a long time where they're slowly closing off this, I don't know, digital prison behind us. And if we allow the United Nations to be in charge of this, they're going to rewrite everything. They're going to rewrite the constitution for the world. You did in this article, you sort of differentiated between human rights and they're not inalienable rights. And they do this word game where they start playing with human rights for everybody. And you go, oh,
yeah, they use that word all the time. But then you read their documents and they say, well, actually, human rights are policy tools. And we can decide to ignore your human rights whenever we want if there's a big enough emergency.
So there are privileges that can be revoked.
Privileges that they can revoke as they see fit. And essentially they say, you know, in different UN documents, it's essentially said that if you don't play along with the UN nation established order, then you lose your ability to exercise those human rights, meaning privileges. Yeah, so there is a difference between inalienable rights and which are like, you know, rights bestowed on human beings for being human by God or by the fact that you're human and all this stuff. Yeah. So the UN doesn't believe in those straight up. They don't.
Yeah.
And they say don't. So. Yeah.
They want you to believe. They want to play that sort of blur the definitions of what everything is when you hear
they
human
want to sound
rights.
Like nice guys, you know,
yeah.
And
oh,
we're
human
doing
rights.
This. For the global good and the global commons. And they basically take like, you know, Star Trek philosophy and act like they're the stewards of that, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few type stuff, you know, yeah. That a lot of people that watch Star Trek growing up were like, yeah, I get that. You know, now the UN's going to come out with that on a big, big level, you know, God. And be like, sharing is caring. And you know, I mean, that's basically how the SDGs are phrased, is to sort of be that, you know, but it's being designed and written by people like Samantha Power and Mark Carney and Mike Bloomberg and all these insane people that obviously don't care about the environment. And they certainly don't care about you. They're working for other people and their track record's pretty clear on the kind of world they're going to be building. I mean, Michael Bloomberg is the stop and frisk guy. Right. And weren't people on the left outraged by him? But it's cool if he tells us how to develop sustainably
and
in a way
what
that
kind of,
nets him an insane return on investment.
What kind of sodas you can drink in New York City, too. Right. He was he was that guy. I wonder if Trump was a big Star Wars or Star Trek fan, given his Operation Warp Speed moniker for everything. It seems that they're they're moving in this direction. But this is a dangerous group. Whenever you let the United Nations in charge of anything, I think people have this.
They have a fairy tale idea of what the UN is. So most people sort of see the UN as like, oh, the different public sectors of the world, the majority of the world's democracies are here and they all have an equal seat at the table. No, almost all of the executive power in the UN is in the Security Council, which is five countries, and none of them are going to share it. Even Russia and China that are there refuse to share with the littler guys, even though they represent the challenge to the unipolar order of the US and the West. So the UN Security Council will maintain that power. That's essentially what that is. And, you know, the ones with veto power really are the one that matters there, which are the people that set up the whole Bretton Woods post-World War II system at the end of the day.
Let's wrap up with this. Just because it's a term that we hear a lot late. Well, we're hearing it a lot more. Can we sort of just hammer out the difference between shareholders and stakeholders? Because we hear stakeholders a lot. It's this new word, as you know. And
it's a buzzword.
It sounds like human rights when you talk about stakeholders. Like, oh man, I got a stake in this. You know, I've got a seat at the table. And then you start to dig into it and you go, this is just like bullshit. This doesn't mean anything. It doesn't really mean what you think it means. So how are we allowing ourselves to, not that shareholders necessarily was the greatest system in the world either.
Definitely
but
neither are good. Yeah.
To pivot to this stakeholder, which is all wrapped in ESG and huggy-touchy, we're saving the world horseshit and all this stuff. And you hear it, and every time I hear somebody start talking about stakeholders, I immediately go, I start to pay attention. I go, okay, here I'm about to hear some bullshit. So what is stakeholders, capitalism?
Right. So shareholders are people that have money or, you know, a percentage of ownership in something financially. Right. And so a stakeholder is different. So the idea is that, like you said, these are the entities that have a stake in this particular thing. And the stake isn't necessarily financial. And this is really the, you know, the whole idea of stakeholder capitalism, for example, which is from Klaus Schwab. The idea is that it's a more responsible form of capitalism away from shareholders. So you're giving people a stake in the thing, but they're not necessarily the people with the money. And essentially what this is a way to make people think that they have a voice in this stuff, when in reality, that's not how it works. So a lot of the stakeholders that are used to represent the community are, they refer to them as civil society. Ian Davis has a great article about what civil society actually means on Unlimited Hangout. Just search for civil society deception. What's the people chosen or the groups chosen to represent civil society, meaning you, a lot of these are like NGOs that were created or are bankrolled by the same billionaires that are the other stakeholders. You know what I mean? So like, you know, an NGO made by like funded by Bill Gates or funded by Pierre Omidyar and the Omidyar Network or funded by USAID or who knows, you know, it could be any of these guys, but they tend to not actually give you any agency in the decisions, but they act like they've taken the community into account. And it's this whole gobbledygook of words to make it sound like it's more responsible capitalism, but really it's not at the end of the day. And, you know, a good illustration of this, going back to the UN, this fairy tale vision of what it is. So like I said, there's this idea of needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, and everyone has an equal seat at the table, but they don't. In the late 90s, Kofi Annan, then Secretary General of the UN, gave this speech at the WEF, and he was like, the UN has undergone a silent revolution, and now the business of businesses globally is now the business of the United Nations. And we essentially, he didn't say it directly, but he essentially says we now do the bidding of the multinational corporations. And not that long ago, the WEF and the UN made a formal strategic alliance, and the UN was going to advance what the WEF was founded to promote, public-private partnership, which is essentially the private sector, multinational corporations capturing all of this. And what they mean by multinational corporations, what we talked about earlier with Samuel Pisar and this global economic entity that's going to be more powerful than the nation state. This is what runs the UN now, and they've openly said so. So in other words, it's really like the bankers, essentially, that are running it. And you can see that reflected in the climate change policy. And very little of the Sustainable Development Goals has anything to do with climate change. One of the 17 goals deals with climate. But that's the way it's being sold and why we have to urgently implement it. And, you know, it's this whole thing with COVID. We have this sense of urgency. We can't do things the way we normally do them or take the time we normally take to do these things. And we can't really talk about it. We can't really debate it because there's no time. So we have to do it now or everyone will die. You know, that was essentially what happened with COVID, and climate change is the same thing. And that's how the SDGs are being sold. But really, it's a banker's game at the end of the day.
Why do you hate the polar bears so much, Whitney? Why? They're just hanging on to those those ice floes, and they need your help, if only. You're the best.
Yeah, maybe some of these nature guys should stop just filming old polar bears and acting like all polar bears are like that now. Anyway, James Corbett did a really good takedown of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's really crazy. Again, like COVID, a lot of it's being blown out of proportion. You can't trust these guys. They want to censor other opinions about the science. They openly say, like one of the top UN ladies as it relates to disinformation, Melissa Fleming is on video saying, we own the science and it's time to let the world know it. And we're working with big tech to censor everything about climate change because we had all these problems with COVID-19 where people didn't believe the science we owned, and then now we know their science on COVID was bullshit, right?
Yeah.
Even if a lot of us knew it at the time, right? But at least now you can't really deny that. So, you know, let's trust them on climate change. You know, up to you, but I'm not into that.
What could possibly go wrong with another invisible enemy that's just around the corner waiting to get us unless we give up our rights and more of our taxes? Whitney, where's the best place for people to catch up with you, follow you, find your work, support you?
So you can follow all of my work, including the series I'm co-writing with Ian Davis on the SDGs on unlimitedhangout.com. The Eric Prince article, originally written for The Last American Vagabond, but after a few days, I always republish every article I write for other sites, including TLAV on Unlimited Hangouts. So that's definitely the best way to keep track of all of my content, including my podcast. And you can sign up for the Unlimited Hangout newsletter, take away the legacy social media as the middleman, and get all the content directly to your inbox, or even better, set up an RSS feed reader and add the Unlimited Hangout RSS feed and the RSS feeds of all other podcasts and websites that you like to read or podcasts you like to listen to, and get rid of these middlemen who are intentionally being targeted to help censor everything under the guise of protecting fundamental freedoms and human rights.
Yeah, well, we know how that goes. These people, they say one thing and do another thing.
Exactly.
And they shouldn't be trusted. But hey, listen, go out and support Whitney's work. She's doing outstanding. And if you don't have One Nation Under Blackmail, Volume 1 and 2, you are late to the party, but better late than never. So go get that. And if you want to connect with me, you can do so through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter @macroaggressions. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.